wait while your presentation is loading. I'm Dr. Jim May from Richmond, Virginia. I'm going to shift gears a little bit in two different directions. Look at healthcare from a behavioral health perspective, and also, unlike the previous two presenters that were presenting data from formal research studies, the data that will be included here have either been derived from other studies and or program planning, program evaluation, or quality improvement data that have been collected within our own agency. This is my disclosure slide. You can see there's nobody on the slide. I have no relationships to disclose. No particular conflicts I care to disclose. Most of my conflicts are psychosocial in nature and have to do with my mother. My objectives today, I want to tell you a little bit about our organization and give you a little bit of an overview of the physical health disparities that exist for people with mental illness. I want to talk about specific needs that we've identified within our community because we do believe that, for the most part, healthcare is local. Talk some about the models for integrating primary and behavioral health care, and then talk a little bit about a plan that is emerging in our organization right now for better addressing this mind and body issue for the people that we serve. The Richmond Behavioral Health Authority is established in the Code of Virginia, and we are responsible for delivering mental health, intellectual disability, and substance use disorder services for the citizens of Richmond. That's not to say that we don't deliver any primary care services. We do that in selected component programs of our overall organization. Last year, we served over 8,000 people, primarily at our home-based facility, but we have a number of sites throughout the community where we're also serving people. This translates to just a little over 4% of the total population of the city of Richmond last year. And I also want to say we're not just limited in our services to the citizens of Richmond. That's our initial charter, but we are also contracted with other community mental health providers in a surrounding region. And so my organization, the Richmond Behavioral Health Authority, provides a number of these same types of services that are designed to serve a more regional population that can extend out quite a bit from the center of the city. We currently employ about 440 professionals, and our annual operating budget, not including the regional projects, is about $38 million. Funded through a number of funding streams, including city, state, and federal funds, in addition to fee for service, which, as we all know, is about to change if you have any familiarity with behavioral health care delivery in the public sector. And we've also recently formed a foundation to try to develop some additional resources, financial resources, to help support the services that we provide. Richmond has long been designated as a medically underserved area. We're not the lowest of the low, but here we are, an urban population with a medical school embedded right in the middle, but we still are a medically underserved area. And I think it's not insignificant that we have three different existing FQHCs already within the community, and there's many citizens of Richmond still not being served medically. Just some other indicators of our community needs. We are a very impoverished city, so 35% of our population have household incomes of less than $25,000. Literally a quarter of our population is estimated to be at the federal poverty level or below. 22% of our adult population is uninsured. And in spite of all the federal initiatives with FAMIS and some of the other programs that we have seen grow over the last decade, we still have almost 10%, of the children of the city of Richmond, are uninsured. Again, these are statistics of the whole city population as a whole and not necessarily our service population, but I'll come back to this a little bit later. But you can see that we don't have the healthiest eating habits, and we're generally experiencing all of the types of chronic conditions that you'll hear about at various presentations throughout this conference. One of the more unfortunate statistics that you see here, the second line down, is that 16% of the adults have indicated that they could not see a doctor due to cost. A huge number of the population do not engage in physical activity, and 60% of our population in the city is rated as obese or overweight. So one of the things that we've been looking at is we try to reposition ourselves to better meet the needs of the people that we're already serving. We feel like we've developed a pretty good system of care with regard to the behavioral health, intellectual disability, and substance use disorder needs that our consumers serve, but we want to be able to serve the whole person. And so we've done some surveys recently under a couple of different grants that we've had from the state and federal government. And one of the things we rapidly identified is that 95% of the people we're serving are currently being prescribed one or more medications, and over 40% are being prescribed five or more medications. And we know that the risk of medication errors tremendously increases when you get to that number. Over half of the people that we're currently serving, 56%, are reported users of nicotine products, and 86% of those are using nicotine on a daily basis. And this is just reported by the consumers. Our best estimate is that the information reported by our consumers represents an understatement of the actual level of problem. 50% say right off the bat they have high blood pressure. Over 40% of experienced numbness and tingling in arms and legs. 40% have shortness of breath when walking, and over 40% have difficulty walking upstairs or inclines. Slightly over a third, almost 40%, have been told by the doctor that they have diabetes or high blood sugar or borderline for sugar problems. Over half have been told by the doctor that they are obese or overweight. And remember, I said 60% of our city's population has been said that, so that's one indication that these are probably underestimates of the extent of their obesity problems. And to kind of put an exclamation point on that, the Gallup Organization Well-Being Index recently rated Richmond to be the second fattest city in America. Nothing that we're particularly proud of, but something that says we've got a lot of work to do. So what are the problems we're trying to address here? Number one, people with serious mental illness are affected by a number of health disparities. We've seen in studies that have been out for over 10 years now that if you have a serious mental illness, you generally are on a trajectory to die 25 years earlier than the general population. I just saw a presentation yesterday that had data to show that when you add coexisting substance use disorders to this, then it becomes more like 30 or 31 years earlier than the general population. And a number of the people, that we serve do have both serious mental illness and substance use disorders. And although suicide and injury account for about 30 to 40% of this excess mortality, 60% of the premature deaths in people with schizophrenia are due to medical conditions such as cardiovascular, pulmonary, and infectious diseases, the kind of things that affect all Americans. A lot of life is lost as a result of these things. This is probably too small for you to read, but just trust me that the slide is basically showing that the data that was used by the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors on this national study was taking data from seven different states, including Virginia, which is where I'm from. And this is clearly a high-risk population. Some of the data that was derived from that same study broke it down by at least the two most common serious mental illnesses, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And you can see that there are greatly higher risk for virtually all of these other medical problems that they have. So what do we want to do about this is the kind of question that's been tossed around at our organization for the last 2 years. It's very clear that the federal health care reform is promoting and incentivizing integrated primary and behavioral health care in terms of service delivery. So I think we can say pretty assuredly that some level of integration, some type of integration is coming. So the question remains, what form is that going to be taking? Some initial models of integrated care have already been initiated through pilot projects primarily funded by the federal government. And most of these are pulled right out of the Affordable Care Act. Section 2703 outlines the community-based health home, and we've also heard a lot of sessions this conference about patient-centered medical homes, and I'll be talking in a minute a little bit more about the FQHCs and FQHC look-alike programs the gentleman over here was asking the previous speaker about. Just briefly, the community-based health home is one of the opportunities for providing integrated care. This is something that needs to be initiated at the state level, but this is proceeding very slowly in Virginia. And one of the unknown commodities that everybody in this room is familiar with is that the Affordable Care Act, while providing a general framework, essentially leaves it to the 50 states to figure out how it's going to be implemented on a state-by-state basis. And given the political nature of the times that we're living in right now, the Commonwealth of Virginia is kind of on record as saying they don't want to play ball yet with the Affordable Care Act. So we're not quite sure when all of this, thank you, is going to actually come trickling down to us. But I think if not before the end of this administration, certainly in the next one, we'll probably get on board with this stuff. But we don't know what the situation is in Virginia around community-based health homes. Patient-centered medical home is another model of integrated primary care, and currently the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services and AHRQ are working towards better defining exactly what this looks like. One of the projects that they funded recently in Missouri, I think, actually provides some good examples where a behavioral health service organization can become a patient-centered medical home. The phrase that we like to use around my organization is a behavioral health medical home, where the focus is really the population that you're already serving, behavioral health population, and also addressing then their medical needs. And then the FQHCs, I think a lot of people are familiar with the federally qualified health centers, and now there's another arm of that that's called the lookalike programs, which is very similar in nature, just slight differences in some of the reimbursement systems. And actually a little bit of an easier application process. These are both currently established models that somebody can literally start filling out paperwork and apply for, and could certainly be one of the avenues to proceed if you're a behavioral health care organization and you want to address the medical needs of the consumers that you're serving. So what should or what can be done? We do believe that integrated care is coming, and so we need to think about exactly what does that integrated care environment look like. We also know for a long time now that the significant health problems experienced by people with serious mental illness and substance use disorders put them way, way out on the extreme of health disparities. So it's about time we started talking at conferences like this, as this is one of the groups of people that is clearly impacted tremendously by health disparities in the delivery of care, not quite achieving all that we would like it to do in our country today. We also need to start tracking and monitoring the morbidity and mortality in these SMI populations and SUD populations, not just at the state level, but also at the provider level as well. And that's one of the things that we've been trying to do at our organization. Improved access, I think, is something that everybody's trying to tackle right now. I heard a long session last night about the access conundrum still has not been adequately addressed by hardly anybody. Established standards of care for primary care need to now be imported into and implemented within behavioral health settings. So this is going to be a new set of clothes for us to put on, so to speak, and we need to learn how to address the quality of our care from these perspectives as well. I think probably a lot of people in this room have seen this before, but it's a four-quadrant model that was really developed to look at possible ways of identifying the best places for people to receive their care in the integrated health system. And on the upper two levels, you see are people with high behavioral health needs, on the left, low primary health needs, and on the right, high primary health needs as well. The bottom left hand is people with low behavioral health and low primary health needs, and the lower right are people with high primary health care needs and low behavioral health needs. In all likelihood, people in the lower left and probably both of the lower levels will receive most of their primary care from health clinics, FQHCs, or their primary care docs. And we know that the quadrant two that's identified in the upper left is probably the zeroed-in population for us, people that have high behavioral health needs and not necessarily high primary health needs, although the box you see in the middle talks about if people who are relatively stable, we could also be serving people that are in that quadrant on the upper right as well. So what are we trying to do? We think that what we want to do is become a behavioral health home for our consumers and provide some basic health care service at our site in Richmond that would leverage our existing relationships with our consumers. As a organization that's serving people with severe mental illness and severe substance use disorders, we have consumers who come to see us almost on a daily basis, a weekly basis. Nobody sees them more than we do. Nobody knows them better than we are. We just haven't gotten around to addressing all of their primary health care needs. So one of the things we want to do is figure out how would that look in our organization to allow us to address weight management issues. Thank you. Smoking cessation, blood pressure monitoring, blood glucose monitoring, nutritional education, lipid profile monitoring, asthma, COPD maintenance, and other services that they may need. There has been previous discussion about types of care that could constitute integrated care delivery for behavioral health populations. We identified these as Blunt in 2003 talked about coordinated delivery, co-located delivery, and integrated delivery. And I will say this, that right now in our own organization, we have a couple of both of these. We have an integrated delivery system in our crisis stabilization unit. Our crisis stabilization director is actually here with us today. And we also have integrated service delivery up in one of our specialty mental health units under a small grant funded by one of the state agencies in Virginia. But we also have, actually that's a co-located delivery of services, and then we have coordinated delivery within other sites. And this feels a little bit schizophrenic right now. This is a fairly complicated chart, but it's basically talking about some of the qualitative aspects of each of these three models. And so let me lead to you to the chase here that we think that a very likely path for us at the present time is for us to become a behavioral health home through the FQHC lookalike process. We've done some initial analyses of what it takes to get into the FQHC is ultimately where we'd like to be, but those are only selected in certain cycles by the federal government. The FQHC, you can actually apply for at any point in time. The lookalike status. The FQHC requires sign-offs by all kinds of people in your community, which obviously takes a fair amount of time to build up that kind of support. The lookalike status has a much less of a complicated application process, but one of the things we know from other organizations around the country is that those who have gone on to that have started with FQHC lookalike status, they've had a fairly easy road then moving on to FQHC status, and I think that would put us in a position to be able to provide and to bill for and be reimbursed for the primary care services. So what are the challenges that await us as we try to take this on? Organizational change is always hard. The bigger you are, the harder it is to change sometimes. If some of you might be physicians in practices, you know, where you might have 2 to 6 practitioners in there, imagine 440 people trying to turn that ship around. So organizational change is difficult, and we understand that going into it. We're just now gaining a better understanding of all the primary health needs of our particular population, and we are setting about the business right now, figuring out the financing and sustainability of being able to deliver primary care services on site. So there's a few other issues that go along with that, but I think I'll wrap it up there. We've done some analyses, and we feel comfortable that the FQHC lookalike is the way we want to go, and that's that. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
We have 2 minutes for questions.
Yes, sir. We have purchased the system. We have staff in training for it right now, and our go-live date is April 1st. And there is a primary care module that is associated with that. Everything in this system is modularized, and that's one of the modules that was part of our shopping experience, if you will, when we were selecting the vendor that we did select. Good question. Yes, sir. You know, we've had initial discussions with all of them. There is one who is the largest by far. They have like 4 different sites around the community. And they say very openly that they're not serving any of the people that we serve, so they don't see it as a threat or an overlap in any way. They basically say that they have one licensed social worker who rotates across their four sites, who does like one-stop visits with people who express some minor anxiety or look like they might be depressed, but there's no organized delivery of ongoing behavioral health care there. Now, there's another provider that we have a very close working relationship with, where we'd actually have some of our behavioral health clinicians implanted at their facility right now, and they have a nurse practitioner at our facility. That's the model that we started with, but I'll say this. Right now, that's about a 6 hours out of the 40-hour week at our location, and it's hard to do a clinic when most of the time there's nobody there to deliver the service. And on the other end, the consumers that are going to get services at their FQHC are sometimes waiting over a month to be seen. So there's obviously a lot of need that's not being met in our community right now. Final questions?
We'll have a chance after the
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Mann.